welcome to the New York Society Library. Delighted to see so many of you turning out for the 18th century on a cold night. I'm Sarah Holliday, head of events. And before we get encyclopedic, a quick summary. First, may I ask you to silence cell phones or anything that might disturb the presentation? Thank you. Good citizen. We appreciate that. Second, we are thrilled to have tonight's speaker here on his actual publication date. So, yes, hot off the press, copies of Diderot and the Art of Thinking Freely are available for purchase just outside those doors, courtesy of our friends from the Corner Bookstore, and Dr. Curran will be happy to sign copies after the presentation. In that good old icebreaker question of what historical personage you'd most like to have dinner with, Denis Diderot would be a great choice. Not only did he have an adventurous and contradictory life, he was one of the great polymaths of his era, the same era that gave us people like Thomas Jefferson, by the way. And he knew all the cool people, like Catherine the Great of Russia, and he was willing to share his opinions on every tough subject, even when he had to do it in code. Unfortunately, there's no dinner with Diderot on the menu, but we're lucky to have with us the next best thing. Dr. Andres Curran is the William Armstrong Professor of the Humanities and Professor of French at Wesleyan University. He was also Dean of Arts and Humanities at the University from 2009 to 2013. His award-winning previous book, The Anatomy of Blackness, Science and Slavery in an Era of Enlightenment, is the first comprehensive study of the birth of race in French thought. Dr. Curran is also a fellow in the history of medicine at the New York Academy of Medicine and a Chevalier d'Anglais pour les Femmes Académiques. He has also received grants and fellowships from the French government, the Mellon Foundation, and the National Endowment for the Humanities, most recently an NEH Public Scholarship Fellowship for tonight's book. Kirkus Reviews calls Diderot and the Art of Thinking Freely an intellectually dense and well-researched, yet brisk, journey into one of history's most persuasive dissenters. To introduce him to us, we're proud to welcome Andrew S. Curran.
Genealogy and tracking it down. So I did this with this race book here. I work with travelogues, and then all of a sudden I trace them and follow them to a scientific academy in France, to Berlin, back to London, and then maybe even to the colonies, to a place like the New York Society Library, where someone like George Washington would be reading about these things. So I kind of follow these things around. Now, this is very different from a biography, I've discovered. Biographies are far less clinical, and they're far more untidy. I discovered that my subject emotes. He has emotions. He has needs, his wants, his desires. Sometimes he's infantile. He has affairs. Sometimes he's mean to people. He lies. He lies about himself. He lies to other people. And your editor says, to write about all this stuff. And she, I wanted to follow a big idea that I've gotten into the life. And certainly Diderot has a rich and interesting life. So I want to talk about him briefly here. Bear with me as I kind of work through things. Here's Diderot. Here's the Van Gogh portrait done in said an atheist. And atheists are unseemly. They're written out of the genealogy. They really are. They're written out of the genealogy. Thomas Jefferson, we're going to talk about him as being a deist. And already this is somehow suspect. And Diderot is far more suspect. He is a radical free thinker. So, as I said, he's not the kind of person he's not Alexander Hamilton. He's not Ben Franklin or Virginia Woolf. He's just not part of the kind of people we know in our kind of nexus of big people. Now, if you were to say, who is Diderot, you could say he's the bad boy of the French Enlightenment. He really is. And by the French Enlightenment, we're talking about a time period between more or less 1680 to the French Revolution in 1784. Diderot lives from 1713 until 1784. He essentially kind of covers most of the century and dies 5 years before the revolution. Now, there's three main figures in the French Enlightenment. I'm going to do a class on the Enlightenment here. I'm going to get to Diderot in 2 seconds. But just to give you an idea of this kind of the three main people here, here's Rousseau in Happier Days. Rousseau is a brilliant, melancholy thinker. He's a famous novelist. He's a tremendous political theorist who had an enormous impact on the way we look at the world right now. And he thought that the world was degenerating the more it advanced. The more civilization advanced, the more he thought things were going down the tube. This is exact opposite from what Diderot thinks. Diderot believes in progress, education, bringing people up. And then there's Voltaire, the other person here. Here's Voltaire in this great sketch by Latour. Early on, he's young before he loses his teeth. He's a witty playwright. He's a historian. He's a writer of short stories. We know him from Candide, of course. He's really the first intellectual in many ways. He's a fierce champion of freedom from religion, although he believes in God. So he's a deist as well. So is Rousseau. So Diderot is a harder person to write about in many ways. First, he doesn't have the same amount of letters. His early years as an adult are essentially a desert. There's about 30 letters until he's about age 30. Some of these are probably burned, or they're just lost. Whereas with Voltaire, and particularly Rousseau, who invents the autobiography, there's a wealth of information. And that's the kind of the first challenge with Diderot. The second thing is that he is a staggering genius. And I was confronted with the problem of how do you know about a genius when you're not one? He's a polymath also who follows ideas like a greyhound chases a Dixie cup. Just takes off, and he also works in a very funny way. Whereas someone like Voltaire, who's also a polymath and a polygraph, he would work on different things during the course of the day, but nothing like Diderot. He'd wake up and write an article on sugarcane manufacturing in the morning, then do art criticism until lunch. Then he'd write a novel in the afternoon, a 20-page letter to his mistress, and finally work on a play after dinner. And so reducing this to a chronology, and this is just one day, is maddening. It's absolutely maddening. He doesn't lend himself to a tidy chronology. And then there's, of course, the other obstacle about writing biography. And this is the biorhythm question. This is my great discovery that people age and slow down and eventually die. And so this is also interesting. Biographers confront this question all the time. What do you do with the second half of your life? The first half of his life has a lot of drama. He is born in a tiny city. We'll get back to his home city, which I just love, Nantes, in a bit. But he's born in a small city in near Burgundy, which is called Nantes. Nantes is fabulous cheese, by the way. Nantes. Again, I'll show this to you a little later. It is a tiny city the size of Hoboken. It's about a mile square on a kind of shaved off volcano. It looks like a Game of Thrones set. It really does. It's got this great ramparts going around the city, which were constructed by the Romans, and the French fortified them again in the 17th century. It's an isolated, small city, and this explains a lot about where he came His father was a cutler. A cutler, somebody who manufactures cutlery, surgical instruments, etc. And so he grows up in a small city. He goes to a Jesuit college, a school where he learns Latin and Greek, and also the foundation of Christian theology. And he's actually tonsured. The greatest atheist of the 18th century, in many ways, is tonsured. He becomes an abbot with the top of his head shaved. He goes to this, he enters the minor orders as an ecclesiastic at age 13. He then goes to Paris to continue his education. And here, something happens. His dad drops him off at this small school, and he goes into the school. He gets in trouble in school, of course, but he's a brilliant student. He was always a brilliant student, but always getting in trouble. And after a few years there, he goes into the Sorbonne to study theology. His theology. And here he is bathing in Paris, which is a city of free thinking at the time. And he's profoundly affected by that. He actually drops out of the Sorbonne in 1735. 23. And then he starts 10 years of dilettantism, as we say in French, dilettantisme, where he hangs out, he's estranged from his parents are cutting him off, and he has this kind of terrible distance living in flea pits. You wouldn't think he's going to become famous for anything at this point. And then he becomes a translator and gets involved with a group of freethinkers, and then he starts turning around. He becomes a translator, a freelance translator for a while. And falls in love with a penniless laundress. And here his parents, he finally returns back to his hometown after about 13 years and says, I want to marry this person. And his dad says no and locks him up in a convent where the monks beat him up, shave his head, he escapes and runs back to Paris at this point. And he has a little kind of a tough life at this point. But he gets into publishing at this point. And he publishes something called The Philosophical Fox in 1746. And then he publishes more and more things which are very problematic, including something called A Letter on the Blind, which is really the first atheistic kind of tract. And he also publishes something called The Bijou and Discret, The Indiscreet Jewels, which is essentially a precursor to the Vagina Monologues, which is a satire of court life from about 35 different Bijou who are interrogated with the magic ring. He didn't want that to get out, and of course this is all discovered. He's thrown in jail in 1749, and this is the first half of his life. Jail, 1749. He's arrested and brought to jail, and this is a very important, this is a pivotal moment in his life. He lives for 70 years, and at age 35, he goes into jail for 3 months. And when he gets out, he's branded as the biggest free thinker and purveyor of smut of the time. He is, luckily, the editor of the Great Encyclopedia. I should say a few words about that. Probably this institution, do you own an encyclopedia? Maybe not. The encyclopedia is perhaps the greatest testament to secular thought. It's a triumph of secular thought in the 18th century. This is organized by Diderot. 17 volumes of texts, 11 volumes of plates. It's really an astonishing achievement. And he does this in many ways because he's sublimating. He cannot write anymore. He's going to be followed all the time by Paris, the police spies. Paris was more like Soviet Moscow at the time, or Tehran. It's one of his kind of big theocracy and also a kind of huge surveillance kind of network. And spies were paid by the snitch. Each time they snitched, they were paid, and so they were very eager to find somebody like Diderot in doing things which were untoward. So you couldn't talk in cafes, you couldn't publish things. It was a very tough time, so it's like he sublimates into the encyclopedia for 25 years. And so at the same time he's doing this, Voltaire and Rousseau were already quite established, become internationally famous. Indeed, real things. I am going to die, having sacrificed my entire life to this encyclopedia, and I'm going to die, and that will be it. And he's quite sad. But then he says, starts thinking about posterity, and that's what he is his salvation. He thinks that posterity is for the philosopher what heaven is for the man of religion. He thinks that posterity is what he will do, and so what he does is start creating this enormous cache of writing, an astonishing cache of writing. He's thinking about natural selection, all the things that he couldn't publish, he puts into a number of different texts. And these texts, he will finally copy at the end of his life and distribute, and hope they will kind of explode like bombs after the fact. And so this is the structure I'm giving them for this bottle. First, we have a very exciting life for the first 35 years, and then we have a man who essentially senses himself to working in a 6-4 garret office for 20 years where he's writing far less activity. So the first half of the book is much more chronological, moves along. And then I decided that I need to do something much more thematic for the second half. And here we talk about Diderot's views on morality, on politics, on natural history, all his proto-Darwinian ideas. He is somebody who's a pioneer in matters of homosexuality, normativity. And he talks about it in politics. One of the things he does was only discovered quite recently was to write a letter to the American insurgents, as he called them, in 1776. At this point, he's a very old man. He's already been to Russia to work with Catherine the Great. He comes back and he writes this letter to American insurgents as a ghostwriter for this very important book in the 18th century. And he tells the American insurgents that the greatest threat to American democracy will not be from foreign invaders, it's going to come from within. You will have a group of people who become extremely rich, hugely rich, and you might even have a tyrant one day. It's an astonishing, interesting thing. Prescient, we don't know. Anyway, so this is the basic kind of setup of the book. And what I want to do now is talk a little bit about what I enjoyed most about writing this book. You know, a lot of things I enjoyed most about the book, particularly working quite a bit with Judith. So I love imaginary geographies. Clearly, when I am conjuring up a life, I'm conjuring up a psychology, I'm conjuring up marital problems, conjuring up relationships among different people, there's a certain resuscitation that goes on, and I can extrapolate what happens by looking at letters and things like that. I loved doing that ultimately. I love getting into the nitty-gritty of personal relationships, his problematic relationship with his wife, for example. But I also loved thinking about geography so much and figuring out the spaces of his life. And one of my favorite spaces is the space of golf, which I've already talked about before. Here is that city I was talking about, Lyon. I said it's about half an hour from Burgundy. You take the train and you walk up. It's about a mile straight up. It's about 1,800 feet above the valley. It's just a stunning kind of arrival when you get there. And nothing has changed pretty much in this town. There's 8,000 people lived there in the 18th century. There's 8,006 in 2019. It's a very quiet town. There's a couple of cafes. There's a restaurant. And Diderot was a main tourist attraction. I'll talk about that in a second. And the soul of the place is kind of up for grabs. There is a an early 19th century view. The only thing that's changed here is this little house in the corner. That's a Renaissance house, which must have fallen down. And here, I actually grabbed this off Google Maps or Google kind of image. I've been there 5 times, but I just happened to find this image here and said, that looks familiar. Mm-hmm. And that's what goes on in the town. Now, the big change is that in the 18th century, there's a gigantic cross Diderot right about here. There's a gigantic cross. The cross gets taken down for a while, but then in 1884, Diderot's statue pops up here. Mm-hmm. Diderot's statue becomes the center of this very small town. It becomes the identity of the town. Everything is named after Diderot. There is a Diderot Boulangerie. There's a Diderot driving school. There's a Diderot motorcycle dealership. There's a Diderot tabac or cigarette store. And there's also the Diderot Junior High. But my favorite is the Diderot Senior High as well. So the Senior High and the Junior High, both Diderot. And there's a restaurant, of course, the Diderot, which is actually a very good restaurant. One of the things I talked about, going to this town, it's kind of funny. I'm like, the American who's writing on Diderot. And, those little whispers kind of happen. The guy at the hotel is so happy that someone might be working on the subject that the first man I'm there, he comes out and gives me this beautiful knife. It was a copy of a knife manufactured by Diderot's father. The second time I go there, he gives me a marble bust of Diderot. And I go into a store to buy an umbrella, and I'm like, oh, you're the American. It's really great. So I want to read from the book a little bit, but what I want to do tonight as a special treat, particularly to Judith, is read something from what I call my compost heap. I have an enormous compost heap from this book. It's gigantic. We worked on so many different things. We didn't know how to get into this book, as I've described the life, complicated life, getting into a life, there's so many different ways to do that, and I think I probably had about 20. And the first time I thought about this, I said, I'm going to write like Diderot. Diderot had this fantastic, expansive, expressive, vibrant style, and he would make his prose dance in a way that life vibrated. I say he's an atheist, but he's actually what people have called an enchanted materialist. That he loved life so much. He's not a sad, kind of mucky, facade kind of person who is a nihilist. He believes in morals. He believes in humankind. He's an essential. He's really much an optimist. So, at the same time, he loves thinking about the materiality of who we are. Everything is based on that. So that's where I thought I'd start, except that clearly, if you're my public, you wouldn't know that because you don't know him, as I said. Nonetheless, I'm going to read this here. If Denis or Denis Diderot had provided the first paragraphs for his own biography, he might have begun by evoking the precise moment where he was conceived on a January night in 1713 on the Place Chambeau. This was, after all, how he liked to tell his friends life stories. Angélique Diderot, his very devout mother, would have been the first actor in the short comedy. The equally pious Didier Diderot, a balding, perpetually smock-covered cutler who came home from work smelling of the forge, would have soon joined her on the stage. And on a frigid evening next to a roaring fireplace in the small town of Langres, the two God-fearing folk would have pulled at least some of their clothes off and quickly slipped into bed beneath their fetid wool blankets, acting, they believed, on God's decree to be fruitful and multiply. But as the zygote turned grown man who was produced during this moment would later say, what happened here had very little to do with the deity. It was rather the aching desire to be touched and the craving and lust of his beloved parents that pulled him from the dark void. Love and sex were just the first part of how he would recount his own biography, however. What happened next was generally the most fun for him to tell. Chemical fermentation in epigenetic liquids become activated. A tiny organ was formed, then another, and then a little brain. And then months later, a tiny hominoid was born. Food, love, and instruction made him a boy. Attached to his mother's bosom, he took nourishment. He sensed. He thought. He was instructed. He grew, he walked,
he excelled in school, and he finally left his small town of Langres and made his way to Paris, where, several years later, he was arrested both for heresy and for being a wise ass. Obviously, you couldn't start the book that way, but that was the first way of, I thought we could kind of capture the way he writes. And he writes like that in all sorts of different situations, whether he's writing about art, whether he's writing about morality. And always from this, it's always bubbling up from within. So what I want to do now is read a little bit from the book. See that I love the idea of Genesis, origins, and we actually flipped it and started at the end and then brought it back. So this poem is called Unburying Diderot. Sometime during the snowy winter of 1793, under cover of night, a small group of thieves pried open a door leading to the church of Saint-Roch. Forced entry into the Paris sanctuary was nearly a weekly occurrence during this time of revolution. In the early 1790s, anti-clerical vandals had pulled enormous religious paintings off the walls and slashed the canvases. Other trespassers had made off with more portable works of art, including an exquisite statue sculpted by Etienne Maurice Falconet. On this particular night, however, the intruders came to steal whatever copper, silver, or lead they could find in the crypt located underneath the chapel of the Virgin. Setting to work in front of the chapel's altar, the grave robbers used long iron bars to lever aside the mattress-sized marble slab in the center of the floor. Though they surely had no idea who was buried in the vault, the most loutish of the group, assuming he could read, would still have recognized the name of the writer, Denis Diderot, inscribed on one of the caskets. Dead for 9 years, the notorious atheist had been the driving force behind the most controversial book of the 18th century, the Encyclopedia. This massive dictionary undoubtedly dragged sacrilege and free-thinking out into the open, but triggered a decades-long scandal that involved the Sorbonne, the Paris Parliament, the Jesuits, the Jansenists, the King, and the Pope. None of this history mattered to the burglars. After moving Diderot's lead coffin from the vault, the men simply shook his decomposing body onto the church's marble floor. The following day, Diderot's remains, along with the other desecrated cadavers from the crypt, were presumably gathered up and transferred without ceremony to a mass grave about a mile to the east. Nobody noticed, nobody reported it in the press. Assuming the church's first few remaining parish priests had realized that Diderot had been buried in the church, they were undoubtedly relieved to be rid of the scandalous money. So 20 years before his remains were carted out of the Saint-Roch Church, Diderot had prophetically remarked that whether you rot beneath marble or under the ground, you still rot. Yet being discarded and forgotten among a mound of recently guillotined aristocratic corpses would not have been his preference, atheist or not. Diderot had long expressed a keen interest in being remembered and, if all things worked out, celebrated by future generations. Posterity is the philosophe, he once stated, as heaven is to the man of religion. Diderot's interest in speaking to future generations from beyond the grave had come about out of necessity. In 1749, shortly after the then 34-year-old writer had published a work of intemperate atheism entitled The Letter of the Blind, two gendarmes showed up at his house, arrested him, and dragged him off to Vincennes prison. 3 months later, shortly before he was released, the Lieutenant General de Police made a special trip to the prison to warn the writer that any further immoral or irreligious publications would bring about a jail sentence measured in decades, not months. Diderot took this threat seriously. For the next 33 years, he avoided publishing the kind of inflammatory books that he had authored as a young man. Much of the energy that he might have devoted to such endeavors was redirected toward the all-consuming. When he finally completed the last volume of illustrations in 1772, the now elderly writer was well aware that he was a celebrity throughout Europe and even in parts of North America, but he was not really considered a literary great. His fate, as he admitted quite openly, was perhaps to survive long after his reputation as an encyclopedist had faded, growing ever older and vanishing without leaving a significant work behind. This, in fact, seemed to be the case when he died in 1784. Although several obituaries credited him for being the leader of the generation of thinkers that had utterly changed this country, they also hinted that he had not lived up to his indisputable genius. Even his friends reluctantly agreed. Jacques-Henri Maistre, who revered the man, wistfully acknowledged that Diderot never produced a book that would have placed him among the first tier of our philosophers or poets. Charitable friends blamed the writer's supposedly limited literary production on the burden of the encyclopedia. Others privately ascribed this failing to his famously whirligig brain. As was often the case, the sharp-tongued Voltaire, who both admired and distrusted Diderot, came up with the cleverest remark on the subject. He apparently joked that Diderot's mind was an oven that burns everything that it cooks. What Voltaire and virtually everybody did not know, everyone else did not know, was that Diderot had actually written an astonishing range of improbably modern books and essays. Pour tiroir, for the drawer, as the French like to say. Holed up in his sixth-floor garret office on the Boutarame, for the last third of his life, Diderot produced this cache of writing with the hope that it might explode like a bomb one day. This moment was prepared for carefully. When the author reached his 60s, which was borrowed time in the 18th century, he hired copyists to produce three separate collections of manuscripts. The first and most complete set was entrusted to his daughter, Angélique, whom we know now as Madame de Valdeur. A second, less complete group of writings was transferred to his designated literary heir and devotee, Jacques-Antoine Desjean. And 6 months after his death, 32 bound volumes of manuscripts, along with Diderot's entire library of 3,000 books, traveled by ship to Catherine the Great in St. Petersburg. Diderot's unedited books, essays, and criticism far surpassed what he had published during his lifetime. Among these writings were two very dissimilar but equally brilliant novels. The first of these, La Religieuse, The Nun, is a gripping pseudo-memoir of a nun who suffers unspeakably cruel abuse after she announces that she wants to leave her convent. The second, Jacques le Fataliste, is an open-ended anti-novel where Diderot used fiction to take up the problem of free will. But there are also thick notebooks of revolutionary art criticism, a godless science fiction-like chronicle of the human race, a secret political treatise written for Catherine the Great, and a humorous satire on the absurdity of Christian sexual mores set in Tahiti, as well as some of the most moving love letters in the history of French literature. That's true. To become familiar with the range of Diderot's work is to be stupefied. Among other things, the philosophe dreamt of natural selection before Darwin, the Oedipus complex before Freud, and genetic manipulation 200 years before Dolly the Sheep was engineered. These hidden works did not appear in the months after Diderot died. They trickled out over the course of decades. Several of his lost books were published during the waning years of the French Revolution. Others appeared during the course of the Bourbon Restoration, which was 1814 to 1830, while still more of his writing emerged during the Second Empire, 1852 to 1870. Perhaps the most significant addition to Diderot's corpus came in 1890 when a librarian discovered a complete manuscript version of Diderot's masterpiece, Rameau's Nephew, in a bouquinist's stand on the banks of the Seine. In this riotous philosophical dialogue, the writer courageously gave life to an unforgettable anti-hero who extolled the virtues of evil and social parasitism while preaching the right to unbridled pleasure. To say that the arrival of these lost books had an effect on subsequent generations would be putting it mildly. Diderot's effusive art criticism inspired Stendhal, Balzac, and Baudelaire. Emile Zola credited Diderot's vivisections of society as the foundation of the naturalism that characterized his and Balzac's novels. Social theorists, too, were spellbound by Diderot's prescient thought. Karl Marx, who borrowed deeply from Diderot's musings on class struggle, listed the writer as his favorite author. And Sigmund Freud credited the Ancien Régime thinker for recognizing the unconscious psychosexual desires of childhood in Rimmel's nephew, long before he or his fellow secularists had. If many critics continue to disdain the writer as too atheistic, too paradoxical, too unrestrained, Diderot was nonetheless becoming the preferred writer of the 19th century avant-garde. The full extent of Diderot's influence was not truly known, however, until a young German-American academic named Herbert Wiechmann located the final lost cache of Diderot's writings. Having heard rumors that Diderot's conservative descendants continued to possess some of the lost manuscripts originally given to the writer's daughter, the Harvard professor finally obtained permission to visit the family chateau in Normandy in 1948. After overcoming the post-war suspicions of the caretaker, who was put off by his German accented French, Wiechmann was ultimately directed to some armoires in the chateau's second floor. Entering a room that contained several large freestanding closets, he sidled over to the first one and peeled back the door panel. Hoping perhaps to find a lost work, or maybe two, he was confronted with an enormous stockpile of Diderot's bound manuscripts. So stunned was Wiechmann that he simply dropped to the floor. Diderot's final cache, the lost collection of manuscripts that he had given to his daughter, had at last been found. What are now known as the Valdun Archives, labeled as such since they came from Diderot's daughter, Madame Valdun, have become the most important source for what we know about Diderot and his works. Most astonishing, perhaps, was the discovery of several manuscripts annotated in his hand that revealed that he had been the primary ghostwriter for Abbé Hanin's Philosophical and Political History of the Two Indies, the best-selling critical examination of European colonization. It had been Diderot, as it turned out, who had penned the most influential and best-known anti-colonial sections of this multi-volume book, including an imagined exchange between an enslaved African who not only claimed the right to be free, but who predicted a day when Caribbean slaves would justifiably put their masters to the sword. Composed in 1779, a decade before the events in Saint-Domingue, Haiti, would prove him right. This is perhaps the most telling example of the writer's radical politics, not to mention his ability to see in the future. Some 300 years after Diderot was born, he has now become the most relevant of Enlightenment philosophers. That he refrained from publishing or taking credit for his most forward-looking ideas during his lifetime was not simply a matter of avoiding persecution. He intentionally chose to forego a conversation with his contemporaries in order to have a more fruitful dialogue with later generations, us, in short. His heartfelt hope was that we, the sympathetic and enlightened interlocutors of the future, might finally be capable of sitting in judgment of his hidden writings, writings that not only questioned the moral, aesthetic, political, and philosophical conventions of the Ancien Régime, but our own as well. So I'd love to take some questions about the book, maybe about Diderot, maybe about writing the book.
Who was his contact in the American insurgency? Who did he write?
He didn't. So the question is, to whom did Diderot write specifically when he was talking to these American insurgents? He actually did this in a very kind of hypothetical way. He did this all the time as a kind of typical epistolary trick, where you're writing to people like this. And he was just generally addressing the American insurgents in general. This said, he was through this person I alluded to, Raynal. Raynal was in contact with Benjamin Franklin, and so there was a real lineage there. There's a real kind of transmission process, and we don't know whether Diderot really was involved with that specifically or whether he always went through Raynal. He was a ghostwriter and terrified of the things he was writing. He was writing things about Louis XVI that would have had him thrown in the Bastille, and he was certainly writing things about America and about tyranny and freedom that were not consonant with the way life was in 1776 in France.
In what way did he then foresee America falling prey to a
Well, I think he was looking at the European model. I think there is these great conjectural models, governmental political models, and certainly he had seen that in Europe, as people became wealthier and wealthier, that corruption would follow. In many ways, he was kind of borrowing from Rousseau here a little bit, that the wealth actually could produce terrible problems at the same time as generating wealth. So he did see a future as going in two different directions. He saw the United States as this great, wonderful republic that suffered from slavery. He thought if the United States could get rid of slavery, it could be the promised land. This democracy, it's really an unthinkable idea in the 18th century. And so he was really excited by this whole thing. He said he would love it. He was too old. He wanted to travel to the United States and meet the Quakers and meet the people of Philadelphia in particular. He thought Philadelphia and Pennsylvania was a great place. So,
but how did he, from that, get the idea that this world could establish a dictatorship as a, when the framework, the framers of the Constitution really, I think, were phenomenal in mind.
Right, so the question is, how did he think that this could lead to tyranny, dictatorship in the United States? And I think it's regressive history. The idea that things could get worse over time, particularly if there's just too much wealth. He thought that if people stopped exercising, stopped doing things, stopped working, they'd be like aristocrats. Aristocrats in the 18th century did not work. He thought work was very important for people's identity. He was a bourgeois, the son of a cutler. He thought these were really good values. And great wealth does not produce entrepreneurial people in this, from this perspective. And the most extreme version of that would be kind of oligarchy, people anointing somebody who are not, who don't have the interests of the people at heart. I think that's what he was thinking.
Thank you, Peter. Talk. It's interesting to me that there's so few letters and respondents that we have to Diderot. And I'm wondering whether that's because he was afraid that the letters would fall into the hands of authorities. Is that the case? Were they just lost? I mean, I would have thought that given that he was cut off, excluded from the public, sphere, that he would have been very gracious in exchanging letters with the likes of Voltaire.
Well, I should qualify this because there are, I think there's 12 volumes of letters. I looked out, I've sent 76,000 emails in the past 8 years. I'm not sure what that would fill up, but he certainly filled up a lot of volumes too. But early on, it's very tough. One of the things he did was he fell in love with somebody who was not terribly literate. I mean, she could read a little bit. And so the exchange between him and her is very rudimentary. Later on in life, he falls in love. The love of his life is a woman named Sophie Verlon. And they exchanged 500 letters, and they're astonishing letters. She, at the end of her life, said, "You must give me back all of my letters and burn them all." And they burned about half his. But this is the greatest window into his life. And so we have a kind of a snapshot. We don't have her letters. She must have been astonishing, because for him to write so much to her, she must have been, on the same level. And she was wonderful. And there are lots of, there's a lot of correspondence, but he was a sloppy man, I think, in a lot of ways. Unlike, he didn't have a personal secretary. In the 18th century, you would have a personal secretary. You often kind of take this all, you would take a copy of the letter, and it would be much more kind of organized. He was, he edited, probably 30,000 articles for the encyclopedia. He wrote 7,000 articles for the encyclopedia. The man was just astonishing. And he was not great with his correspondence. Now certainly there are a lot of letters out there, but it's funny where you're going through and there's like 4 months where there's nothing. There's these giant ellipses in the record. Still in all, I pieced together his life, which makes a lot of sense. And he was in contact with a lot of people, but he didn't have the same kind of international network that someone like Voltaire was. He was in Paris. Voltaire was exiled to Ferney in the Swiss borders and kind of created this enormous kind of network. And he's writing all sorts of different people. Thoreau was kind of making it work, making the Enlightenment work in Paris, I think, too. So there's less letter writing. Letter writing is positive on distance and separation. He was kind of the thick
Would you talk about how you decided to organize the book, and did you change your mind as you were writing?
Well, so how did I decide to organize the book? One of my great confessions, another confession that I've actually talked about with my students, and I have a student here tonight, is that I don't like, I've written three books, I don't like outlines. I've never had an outline. I believe in radical empiricism. By Diderot, in many ways. And so it took shape by itself, I think. And I think that I first kind of worked through the kind of chronology and stumbled, and it wasn't holding together. There weren't great transitions between the different areas of his life, kind of the overarching categories which allow us to kind of understand who he was. And then later on, I had to, not artificially, but piece together these kind of thematic units. Because he would write about, for example, human sexuality in a novel, in an essay, in somewhere else, in letters to Sophie Vodon, and piece them together into these more digestible units. And so the second half, you kind of imagine him up in his garret writing, the second half of the book really assembles these things into units that you can understand, and hopefully they're fun too. Okay?
Or elaborate on the phrase "the art of thinking freely," and what did you see that Diderot saw as thinking freely? And does it involve how you live your life, what you question in your actions, or do you have to step back in retreat to a garret and write? Or I mean, and what does it have to do with open-mindedness? And what can that tell us about our lives, intolerance in our society?
What a great question. I mean, we'll get to the heart of the whole thing here, don't we? So the art of thinking freely. There's a term, free thinker, that I've alluded to, and we hear about that quite a bit now. In the 18th century, the notion of free thinking was close to being a libertine. A libertine, somebody who had freed his or her mind from dogma. There's another thing I think is interesting about the term heretic in the 18th century. The term heretic in the 18th century, you think about somebody who's violating aspects of a particular religion. But as I looked this up in a catechism manual, I spent lots of time thinking about these kind of things. The definition was somebody who had ideas on his own. Right? And so you have to understand that this is a man who's growing up in Nantes, where dancing is bacchanalia. Theater is when you go to a dark room. His thoughts will habit you necessarily. And he's kind of learning about the faith by catechism, where it's a rote learning process, memorizes things, etc. And now we think about free thinking as somebody who might be a radical in some ways, but there's a kind of specific sense of breaking free of a lot of received authorities, both social mores, religious conventions, etc. And this is what he did, and scientifically as well. Science was imbricated, was contaminated by religion. Embryology was perfectly compatible with creationism 7,000 years before. There's so many biological explanations of the 18th century were infused with ideas from religion, and Diderot wanted to separate them. And free thinking also was a question of methodology. How do you approach questions? And so it's a distillation of what we know from Locke, the distillation of what we know from Bacon, these kind of great English thinkers from the 17th century. It's the idea that you approach a question not only with an open mind, but by rejecting all received authorities. That was free thinking for him. And certainly, he could not be a free thinker. He was practicing self-censorship for 35 years, but he paradoxically had freed himself by not respecting the conventions, the writing, the literary conventions, and the social conventions, and the religious conventions of his time, because he didn't have to worry about publishing. He really was free thinking, even though it was a time of the future.
That's exactly the question I wanted to ask you.
Diderot subsists, it's correct. Well, this is a fun story. Because Diderot, he worked, with the encyclopedia and was pretty well paid until 1773. At that point, he gets really nervous because the money's about to run out, his daughter's going to get married, he starts to panic. And he asks his friend Grimm to put an ad in this thing called the Literary Correspondence, which is this manuscript-only newspaper. It's circulated among 8 or 15 princes and queens of Europe, including Catherine the Great. And in this newspaper, they say, look, Diderot was thinking about maybe selling his library, maybe this 3,000-book library, which was part of his payment for being the encyclopedia. And Catherine the Great was trying to ingratiate herself with all these philosophes. It's kind of like collecting rock stars. She says, I think that's a good idea. I'll buy it for 15,000 francs, a lot of money. I'm not sure how much that is, probably 80,000 or something like that. Don't quote me. It's a lot of money. So Diderot's quite happy. And then a year later, she says, here's the stipulation. You get to keep the library, and you're the curator of the library, so I'll pay you to be the curator. So he gets the money, keeps the books, and gets paid for keeping the books. And this is great. But the following year, it forgets the pain. No problem. And he just mentions it to somebody, and this guy writes to Catherine, and Catherine writes back, I don't want some small, squirrely functionary screwing this up from now on, because so I'm going to pay you 50 years in advance, and then we'll renegotiate when you're 103. She has this great joke. She says, 50,000. This is like $800,000 or something. Just an astonishing sum. So at this point, he's free. But he had always rejected patronage, but at this point he had enough money to kind of operate, and that's why he goes to Russia to kind of pay his respects and also try to reform Russian society. Thank you.
After he dies, who winds up with his works and then releases them, as you said, over time?
Yeah, that's the question of the, is this a question of when his books are released over time? It's a long, long story. So there are certain manuscripts which are in St. Petersburg, and there are people who go there and copy them and then bring them back and publish them. There are manuscripts that were stolen during the Revolution and pop up after the fact. So his buddy Grimm has some manuscripts which kind of show up. So it didn't work as he wanted exactly. They trickled out. The family holds on to these things. He was surely talking about doing my complete works. I'm sure he envisioned something that looked like this, on the back of all my complete works finally, but it didn't happen like that. It popped out every 5 or 10 years. A bunch of things happened in 1796. The novel of Religieuse and Jack the Fabulous came out in 1796. And then later on, these things started slowly coming out. And that's why the 19th century was so astonished by many of his works. It was a funny thing because he was just seen as an encyclopedist, kind of journeyman, vulgarizer of ideas. And it turns out he was the person who was in many ways way ahead of everyone else.
What was his connection with the mathematician
Dalembert? So, this is Jean-Laurent d'Alembert. D'Alembert was a very famous, brilliant mathematician who was the co-editor of the encyclopedia with him. They were both hired in 1747. This is before Diderot goes to jail. And D'Alembert was a famous face. He's kind of a kind of Francis Newton in many ways. He had done amazing things, had solved all sorts of problems as a young man. He was seen as genius figure. He was the public face and respectability of the encyclopedia. Everyone knew that Diderot was a genius. The publishers knew he was really, really smart. They also knew that he would get in trouble by publishing things. I'm sure there was going to just knock that off. But they were kind of good friends for a while. D'Alembert couldn't take the heat. 1758, he drops out of the encyclopedia project. And then later on, Diderot writes this wonderful kind of proto-Darwinian crazy thing called D'Alembert's Dream, which has D'Alembert dreaming, thinking about natural selection and cloning and all sorts of stuff. And D'Alembert and his girlfriend, back in the 1700s, were not
enchanted materialist is a very interesting expression. Is the enchantment in the materialist or in the materialist which reciprocates?
So this is a question about enchanted materialism. Alas, I did not come up with that expression. A very famous woman named Elizabeth de Fontenay did. But this is something I think is just a terrific idea. So you may have heard of Lucretius and the pre-Socratic atomists who think about matter as just everywhere, and they don't see kind of a separation between this and me and the ground and everything else, the circulation and endless circulation of matter, a bubbling, fermenting world. And Diderot takes this and thinks about it in his relationships too. So he doesn't think of death as this kind of final, awful darkness. He thinks of his essence coming together with the essence of his lover and maybe kind of growing into a plant or something. So he really believed in this kind of endless cycle. He talks about life as being, you know, walking between two eternities, which is such a beautiful expression. And this is real part of his materialist view of the world. So materialists are often seen as reducing everything to the kind of degree zero of existence. For him, it was something much, much more animated and fun. So, yeah, with that. I think they said that's the last question, or one more? Okay, one more question.
The man who discovered the manuscripts, did he have any idea? How did he come to him and just decide to go to
Right, so this is the question about Hermann Dieckmann, the German-American academic who was at Harvard. He'd been tracking down to one of these manuscripts, the same Dalinger's dream, for many years, negotiating with the family would turn into a very upstanding family. You know, they were proud of Diderot and also ashamed of Diderot. Finally, he negotiated the possibility of doing this, but he was a very, very serious scholar who ended up doing the complete works of Diderot. So, he was a really, really very, very eminent and knowledgeable person. So that's how we tracked it down.
So then he ultimately helped
Yes, he was one of the driving forces behind the clinic.